You can take on new assignments in areas you don't really know. And if you recruit the right people, set the right goals, and everybody works very, very hard, you can accomplish amazing things.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. John Connors has crafted quite the extraordinary life for himself. A University of Montana accounting program graduate, John rose through the ranks of Microsoft from 1989 to 2005 to be the chief information officer and later its chief financial officer. Today, John applies what he learned working alongside Microsoft founder Bill Gates and CEO Steve Ballmer as a managing partner of Ignition Partners, a leading early stage enterprise software investment company with more than $1.5 billion under management. He also serves on the board of companies he has helped launch and work with, including Parse, Splunk, Live Stories, and Nike. He and his wife, Kathy, share a deep commitment to community with a philanthropic focus on youth education, faith communities, and free market think tanks. Not bad for a kid who grew up working on farms and ranches in rural Miles City, Montana, one of seven children of a journalist mother and teacher coach father. Today on Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we visit with John and learn more about his life's work and lessons learned along the way. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Phyllis and Dennis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communications solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Great to see you again, John.
Arnie, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me to this interview in your home office here at Ignition Partners in Bellevue, Washington.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and it's a real pleasure to be on your show.
First off, as a kid growing up in rural Miles City, Montana, working as a paperboy on farms, ranches, later on railway crews in the oil fields of eastern Montana and North Dakota, then on to the University of Montana for a degree in accounting, did you ever envision 30 years ago that you'd end up where you are now?
No, I did not, because, you know, there's just no way to predict what career path you're going to ultimately follow, how many companies you're going to work with. And I just feel really fortunate to have been a guy getting out of school in the early 80s in the very early stages of the technology boom, and landing with a company that ended up being one of the most important participants in the tech revolution. Could never have envisioned it.
So what was it about a small town upbringing that prepared you for that?
Well, I was born on third base, in that my parents had an incredible relationship. They loved each other very much. We had seven kids in our family. They were not wealthy, but they were pillars of the community. They loved each other very much, and we all seven of us kids grew up knowing we were loved and stable and confident. And so I started on third base. And then secondly, as a young person, I was able to work in so many different jobs in eastern Montana. And Arnie, you know what a work ethic Montanans have, and eastern Montana work ethic is like nowhere in the world I've ever seen. I worked on ranches, I worked on large cattle operations, I worked on oil rigs, I worked on railroad labor gangs, and learned how things were done, but mostly worked around incredibly hardworking people that were very good at operating complicated machinery, figuring out how to take care of livestock, figuring out how to get large teams of people to work together on these railroad gangs. And I worked with a lot of very tough people that you either showed up and did the job, or they let you know very directly you didn't do the job very well. And that was a great, great lesson that I learned very early.
You mentioned Microsoft, and I don't want to dwell too much in the past because there's been, you know, 13, 14 years since you've worked there. But you were there in your 20s, starting in 1989 through 2005, at a period of tremendous growth. When you started there, there were like 4,000 employees, and the revenue was under $1 billion. When you left, it was a $40 billion company with 60,000 employees. Now, 13 years later, it's a $110 billion company with 130,000 employees. You know, looking back now, how do you evaluate your experience there?
I have just great memories of so many positive interactions and so many relations and so many things I learned on so many dimensions. You worked with people from all over the world that were either employees of the company or were customers. You got to meet people from every imaginable industry in the world and every country in the world, because as long as the country had money, Microsoft sold them product. And the combination of dealing with rapid growth, but dealing with people from all over the world in every single industry, it was a life lesson and set of experiences that you can't even really describe.
In the 13 years or so since you left, could you foresee where Microsoft is now?
Well, Microsoft has always been one of the most important companies in the world the last, 25 plus years. And we're very close to both Microsoft and the Amazon organizations because we invest principally in enterprise software. And Amazon through their AWS business and Microsoft are the two most important enterprise companies in the world. So we work real closely with them. Every single one of our companies we invest in has both Microsoft and Amazon employees. Our investments in the Silicon Valley have Microsoft and Amazon employees. And so you can't not know what they're doing if you're in enterprise software. It was really clear that Microsoft was on an incredible resurgence long before it was visible to the markets. And where it was visible was they had been working on both Office 365 and Azure, their cloud business, for some time. And we were kept abreast of what was happening. And it was really only a matter of time before they started the business model shift to selling those products in the cloud. The extent of the turnaround and the speed is fairly remarkable, because getting an organization of that size to shift its business model is very difficult. Very few organizations are able to do it. What really helped Microsoft is 8 miles away to the west of them is AWS, and the only company that was moving faster than Microsoft was AWS, and they could see very clearly what AWS was doing, and that was a huge catalyst for their transformation.
And for our listeners, AWS does what?
Excuse me, Amazon Web Services. So it's Amazon's cloud computing division.
When you were in the midst of all this, did you know something extraordinary was happening on a day-to-day basis? I mean, you're in the late 80s, through the 90s. Could you sense on a regular basis that this was different than anything else that had ever happened before?
No, not really, because you just got up every day and went to work for 12 hours. And then when I got home from work, I tried to help my wife as best I could with our four kids. But it became your job, and it became just the routine of, well, this is the industry you're in, and it's growing very fast. And in parallel to Microsoft's growth was the incredible growth and diversification of the economy in Northern California that everybody in the world now knows as Silicon Valley. So there were thousands of us in the United States experiencing this same thing, and it just became your normalcy every day.
You know, historically in the business world, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, they made their money by having things, railroads and mines and shipping companies and all that. I heard once someone describe Bill Gates as he was the richest man in the world at the time, and he could walk through a metal detector at an airport with everything that made him that wealthy in his pocket and wouldn't set off the metal detector. I mean, that's a fundamental change in the accumulation of wealth and the value of company in terms of what they make and produce.
Yeah, the advent of software has really transformed not just the software industry, but the entire world. And the interesting thing about Microsoft was your most important assets walked in and out of the company's doors every day. And the other part of Microsoft's incredible success that is well known by people that really understand and study the company was the incredible channel of distribution that was created. There's millions of people around the world that wake up every day and their primary occupation is designing, deploying, or supporting Microsoft technology solutions in businesses and organizations of every size. And that channel asset plus the employee IQ asset is really a unique thing that no company had created before. And it really was transformational.
Not to mention the fact that if anybody, including me, can't get into my Microsoft office in the first thing in the morning, I like freak out if there's something wrong with it or it's down or whatever. I mean, you come to rely on it. It's an integral part of your life, which never really happened before that.
Well, in some ways, I think we all probably feel technology is maybe a little too integral and we're too dependent and spend too much time on it and not enough time on human interaction and community the way we all grew up. So there's a lot of pluses, but also some not so positive aspects to pervasive technology.
Right, and there's obviously a sense of seeking the right balance for everyone. You worked alongside two of the greatest business leaders in history, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer. What effect did that have on you? What skills, lessons transferred from that experience to your current work at Ignition Partners?
Well, the first thing I would say about those two gentlemen is incredibly hardworking people. And even as they gained, you know, wealth that was almost unimaginable to them and to the world, they continued to work as if they had nothing. The second thing is it really didn't matter how wealthy you were, what your title was. They cared about what you thought and what you could contribute intellectually. The third thing is they were unbelievably effective at recruiting talent. And finally, they were just incredibly focused on what's truth. And one of the things that was so fascinating about Microsoft is if you had a meeting, PowerPoint was used extensively. Anybody presenting to Bill and Steve, if you had more highlights on your opening slide than lowlights, it was probably going to be a very bad meeting. They focused intensely on what are the things that need to be improved. They didn't focus on what are the things we need to celebrate. So remarkable men, and what's really remarkable is how effectively they worked together for all those years building one of the world's most important companies.
Last Microsoft question. You held a number of positions all the way up to, you know, chief financial officer over your 15 years there. Which one did you enjoy the most?
You know, I enjoyed each of those jobs that I had in different ways because I was at various stages of my career. I really enjoyed the first job I had just learning the company in the finance group. And then I moved over to work as Steve Ballmer's business manager. And that was fascinating because then I started to learn software. And then my wife and I moved to Paris and I worked in Paris for a wonderful man named Bernard Vernier, who ran Europe. And that was both a great professional and personal experience. I came back as corporate controller, and that was my first introduction to running a large group and building large-scale systems and processes. Then I was chief information officer for several years. Then I was involved in running the enterprise sales group and finally CFO. And I think in a lot of ways, the chief information officer job was the most enjoyable because I knew really very little about technology and had never had an IT-related role, information technology-related role, and all of a sudden I was the boss of this group. And the previous two chief information officers had not lasted in the job very long. And that opportunity that I was given and that job was probably the one that was most transformational in that I realized you can take on new assignments in areas you don't really know, and if you recruit the right people, set the right goals, and everybody works very, very hard, you can accomplish amazing things. But mostly I really learned a lot about information technology and how it's integral to every business process in a company. And that has been great benefit the rest of my Microsoft career and now what I'm doing in venture investing. But it's also fantastic because my wife and I have four children. Only one is in school. He's in his last year at the Air Force Academy. The other three are working, and they're all in technology-related roles. And I can talk to them about their jobs, and they want advice, and they want input. And I just think, how blessed that this 30 years I've spent in technology, I can now talk to any young person in the world, including my four kids, about what's happening in their world, so I still feel relevant.
John, I have to ask you this. At the height of your tenure at Microsoft, at a time when you had led the company to its largest dividend in history and had reorganized it into seven different business units, why did you leave?
There were a couple of real clear reasons. The first was I wanted to have more time with my family and do more things in the community. When you're in a C-level role at a Fortune 25 company, you know, C-level being CEO or Chief Operating Officer or CFO or Chief Legal Counsel or Chief People Officer or Chief Revenue Officer, those are very demanding roles. And I'd probably worked 60 to 65 hours a week for 12 years, 13 years. And I didn't have as much time at home with my wife and kids as I'd hoped. And we still had two kids that were a bit younger at home. They were still in grade school, and I wanted to participate more in their lives. I wanted to get more involved in my community and in faith efforts. But also, I wanted to try this investing in early stage companies. So a multitude of reasons, but primarily it was to have more time for family and community.
So you leave, you join some other Microsoft and Macaw executives who have formed Ignition Partners. What's the mission of Ignition Partners?
The mission is to find great companies, deliver superior returns, and be uniquely valuable to the companies we invest in as investors and board members.
And how do you find great companies? I know you look at more than 100 deals a year and maybe fund one or two. So what singles out that one or two companies from these other ones that don't make the cut?
It's a really great question. And the first thing you really look for is this market being disrupted, and is there a large market opportunity? If there's not a large market opportunity and it's not being changed, or the company's not attempting to change it, it's probably going to be hard to create a lot of value. The second thing you look for is a really strong perseverance gene in the leaders of the company you're going to back, because it's going to be extremely difficult and the odds are really stacked against you. You know, the historical math on early stage venture investing is, this may not be exactly precise, but it's directionally correct. About a third of the companies will lose all your money. A third of the companies, you'll maybe get back the capital you invest, but you won't make any money. And a third of the companies you'll make money in. Well, of the third of the companies you make money in, about 13% account for 87% of the returns. So it's historically been a very home run driven business, which means the odds are long, the work is going to be hard, and these companies are going to face innumerable obstacles. So the team has to have a very, very strong perseverance gene.
I know you drill down a lot when you look at these companies, but how do you really determine what is just noise versus value in a startup?
That's a great question, but it's really hard to know. And quite honestly, at this stage where I'll be 60 my next birthday, the most important thing I have to do is have a really good team I work with, and young people that are really hustling and finding the interesting ideas that we get a chance to look at. And then if we think it's interesting, other firms are also probably going to think it's interesting. And then you've got to really hustle and convince these entrepreneurs that you're going to be uniquely valuable, not just money, but expertise and help. And that's going to be a derivative of what did other people who you've worked with have to say about how you dealt with them. So each of these interactions is very important because there's a marketplace of all these young entrepreneurs that talk to each other about who helps, who doesn't help, who's just money, who really brings strategy, who really brings recruiting help, who really can help get you connected to and introduced to companies that are going to be customers or companies that are going to be partners. And so there's a wide range of things that you've got to try to be very good at in order to win the most coveted deals.
So when you look at, charisma and, and presence and all that, you can kind of start separating the winners from the losers. But what skills are you looking for?
There's different ages of the entrepreneurs we'll see. And generally what, you'll find is with entrepreneurs and teams that have had lots of experience in venture-backed companies or lots of experience in larger companies, there's a network that will know somebody, will either know somebody who knows them or somebody who has worked with them. And you'll be able to find out, hey, what was this person like? Were they effective? Is what they're describing consistent with what your experience was? So the first thing is diligence on those individuals from people you know. But often the companies that get started are by people who are not out of college very long, don't have that much work experience, and in the companies they've been in, they're at levels much lower than the senior level people we might know. And so you just have to spend time with the individual and the entrepreneur to get a sense of, am I comfortable with this person? And do they seem to have what it takes to get to the next stage? And a big part of getting to the next stage is hiring the right team around them, but also being willing to listen and learn from others on their team or outside of the company as they scale to do jobs they've never done before.
You outlined this one-third in the venture world. And obviously among your winners, you've had companies like Splunk, which you've raised, almost $229 million for, Parse, which was acquired by Facebook, Topsy, acquired by Apple. But some of the ones you've chosen also failed. So what derails leaders?
I would say most often the market doesn't materialize in the way that we envisioned. And either the market's not changing or the market's not doesn't end up being disrupted in the way we expected. The second big reason is team dynamics. In these early stage companies, you're trying to get 1 + 1 + 1 = 5. The companies have limited amount of money and limited amount of time. So the CEO and the investors have to orchestrate a perfect combination of events to make these things successful for the next round of financing. And either the market or the team dynamics don't get done properly. And occasionally you'll just build a product that just doesn't work as envisioned. And you run out of money before there's a chance to correct it. The most common mistake, though, once you have a product built, is scaling up sales and marketing before it's ready to be a repeatable process. And if you spend too much money on sales and marketing early, then and the product's not quite ready, or the customer go-to-market's not quite ready, or the customers aren't adopting quickly, your return is going to be severely impacted by that money not driving revenue. And the teams get tired. If there's not some successful milestones in the first 2 to 4 years, once these teams have gotten to 3 or 4 years in, if they aren't seeing success, it's really difficult to keep going, although most do. And what you find, Arnie, is the companies we back, these are very, very talented people. And they could be making far higher salaries at large companies than what they're willing to give up for this big dream. And after a period of time, it's hard to keep the team members because the opportunity cost of not working at Amazon or Google or Microsoft or Facebook or Salesforce is just so wildly disproportionate that they have to go back to making the money that the market will pay them.
We're talking with John Connors, former CFO of Microsoft and current managing partner with Ignition Partners. So what you just said reminds me, harkens back to a quote from Hunter Thompson, who said there's a lot of wreckage in the fast lane these days. And that's what you're up against, right? All these things you've talked about. I want to add another element to this that maybe you can comment on. How can companies manage these long-term versus short-term expectations that investors have, staff have, Wall Street has? I mean, unforgiving Wall Street if you're off 1 cent in your projections. How do you balance all of that?
Realistically, the really good companies don't run their companies for Wall Street. They do have an obligation to report quarterly and then to file annually a lot of detail about what's going on there with their company. But the really great companies aren't run for Wall Street. That's a derivative audience for them. And if a company gets in a position where everything's being done for the quarterly earnings results, generally those aren't companies that are going to last for decades and be dominant players in any industry. But it's a very hard balance, because once you're public, the spotlight on you every quarter and every year is very intense. And I think of it more as the quarterly results and the annual requirements just force you to get better and better and better. And so no company should move from being private to public unless they're really ready for a marathon. Because being a public company is a marathon, not a sprint.
I want to get your thoughts on some trends that we're looking at in business and just, your reaction to them. Cryptocurrency.
Asking this today versus 18 months ago is probably a different answer, but
sure.
The big question in my mind, and I'm not at all an expert on crypto, is will crypto become a legally approved alternative asset class in the United States and in leading Western countries? It appears like in China, crypto is not going to be approved, but will crypto be a legally approved alternative asset class for U.S. investors? If that answer is yes, then it could be a very interesting category. The blockchain that underlies crypto is fantastically interesting. And, for example, one of the former top executives at Microsoft who left Microsoft several years ago is now CEO of a blockchain-oriented company. And we see many different opportunities for blockchain-oriented businesses in the heart of the transactions that the world performs. So blockchain, very interesting. Crypto, harder to forecast.
Yeah, well, the technology of blockchain can be applied to so many industries, almost
yes.
like when the internet first emerged.
Yes,
it's a
exactly.
tool that you can apply to make yeah. businesses more competitive.
And there's a really good book out by a brilliant man named George Gilder that anybody interested in blockchain, I think, should read. And I think the title, I may not have it exactly right, but is I think it's The End of Google and the Rise of Blockchain. But it's a fascinating book and worth reading.
Artificial intelligence.
Very interested in the next generation of analytics. And we have a series of investments in what I like to use the term predictive analytics or advanced analytics versus AI or machine learning, because it isn't, what does AI mean? What does ML mean? There are technical descriptions, but the term AI is getting overused pretty broadly. Very fascinating area, and we have a series of investments. One is in the property and casualty insurance space called Tractable, that is working with leading property and casualty insurance companies in the United States and Europe to help them become way more efficient in the claims process by looking at pictures of accidents. We have a very interesting company in the predictive healthcare analytics space called Kensai that is building at this stage machine learning models for a whole host of things for large hospital and medical groups. Everything from analyzing very large amounts of data to identify who in your patient cohort base is likely going to have prescription conflicts. How long are people likely to stay in the hospital? Who's likely to be readmitted? Where is there fraud in the revenue cycle? And this is enabled only from the large-scale computing that's now capable of being done and building these very industry-specific models. So for us, what we're really interested in are very industry-specific scenarios where we find high-quality data engineers and data scientists with good technical backgrounds, and then we try to marry them up with domain experts in those specific industries. But it's all about getting insights from vast amounts of data that a human can't infer. So AI and machine learning, very interesting categories.
The companies that you take the lead on here, you then get involved and stay involved with them on the board and become a mentor to the senior staff?
Yeah, we get very heavily involved, and generally the routine is you'll have between 6 to 8 formal board meetings a year, which is, you know, 1.5 or 2 times more than a public company. And then you're in constant contact with the CEOs and the teams. And, you know, today I would have had interactions. It's what, 2 o'clock? One meeting we had earlier today is with one of our CEOs. We're raising the next round of financing, and he has term sheets from 3 really high-quality firms. And we sat down as a group to go through the pros and cons of each firm and each partner. Then I'm helping recruit a chief revenue officer for another company. I had a contact with another investor in another company we're in where one of our companies needs money and is spending more money than they're bringing in. And it doesn't look like that's going to change for a while. So you're in constant daily contact, either quick phone calls or in-person meetings, plus more formal board meetings.
You sound like you're invigorated by the diversity of activities that you're involved in with these companies, even though they're in sort of the same sector. Yeah. They all have different problems and challenges and situations. How does that make you feel on a regular basis?
Oh, my gosh. I wake up every day and can't wait to go to work. I haven't had, I think, a single sick day in 13 years of working doing this venture work. What I tell people is it's vastly exceeded my expectations about just how fun it would be. And if anybody gets worried about where America's going, just meet with entrepreneurs. And you will have a very optimistic view of America's future if you spend time with entrepreneurs.
So they look at you as a mentor and a sage. You mentioned one book earlier, but how do you stay up on the trends? What do you read, watch, listen to?
Team is so critical that you work with. And I'll be 60 on my next birthday, so everybody on the team is younger than me. And so their funnel of information that they're getting from meeting with companies, meeting with entrepreneurs, talking to people in technology, it's like a fire hose. You know, I could spend 12 hours a day reading on technology or, you know, looking at company pitches, but I much prefer meeting and talking with people. And I'm not a software engineer, so the level of technical depth I have is not what a software engineer would have. And my conversations are much more about what is the business of this technology is going to be applied to, and tell me about the value this is going to bring to the buyer. Because at the same time that technology's become pervasive and communication has become pervasive, so has information. And so the day of going and educating a customer about the technical details of a product, that's really the past, and that was the 90s. Now, any customers have almost unlimited information technically, and what you really have to be selling them is what is the value and what is the solution that this technology is going to deliver. And as more and more of the applications of the world move to AWS, Amazon Web Services Cloud, Microsoft's Azure Cloud, Google's Cloud, the types of businesses we're investing in are less technical and much more application-oriented, and that market is all about business value.
Many in Silicon Valley in the high-tech sector who have prospered, including yourself, have made a strong commitment to philanthropy. I recently visited the Gates Foundation and was very impressed with their operation here in Seattle. They have $40 billion under management there for philanthropic purposes. What are you and your wife Kathy's philanthropic pursuits?
Yeah, we have a wide range of things we've been involved in the faith-based world. We've also had a large range of endeavors that we've done in free market-oriented think tanks. We've also been real involved in scholarships in a number of places, our hometown, Montana, the University of Washington. And we're also very, very involved in youth sports and youth activities. One of the more recent things we've gotten involved in is a emerging business in Ghana to develop an apparel industry. And that's from a brilliant young gal that was the tutor of one of our kids in junior high for Spanish. And she went on to Yale and then worked at Bain Consulting and now has launched this business in Africa. And we're getting involved in that as well. So a wide range of things, but mostly empowering people spiritually and in getting on the right path.
So what does the future look like for you, John?
Well, hopefully the future includes way more days in Whitefish, Montana, and in southeastern Montana out on our ranch, because Montana is still home, and every time I'm there, my mind tells me this is where you ultimately belong.
What advice do you have for young aspiring entrepreneurs who want a rewarding career?
Work very hard and sacrifice. You will have to sacrifice. Secondly, you have to work effectively with people and like people and be willing to learn from people. And if you work really hard, if you're able to work effectively with people, you probably have the IQ, otherwise you don't go start something generally. If you're willing to sacrifice and if you're willing to work well with people, you're probably going to have a great career.
John, the most extroverted graduate from the University of Montana's accounting program, thank you for spending time with us today.
Arnie, thank you very much.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Join us next time when we discuss financial resources available to entrepreneurs and small business owners with Dave Glazer, president of MoFi, the Montana-Idaho Community Development Corporation. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Phyllis and Dennis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communications solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com.